to learn why unleashing the instinct to play will make our children happier, more self-reliant, and better students for life. Author Peter Gray. What have we done to our children? Children come into the world burning to learn and genetically programmed with extraordinary capacities for learning. All of this is driven by their inborn instincts and drives, their innate playfulness and curiosity. Nature does not turn off this enormous desire and capacity to learn when children turn 5 or 6. We turn it off with our coercive system of schooling. The biggest enduring lesson of school is that learning is work, to be avoided when possible. Children are designed by nature to play and explore on their own, independently of adults. They need freedom in order to develop. Without it, they suffer. Free play is the means in which children learn to make friends, overcome their fears, solve their own problems, and generally take control of their own lives. There is no need for forced lessons, lectures, assignments, tests, grades, segregation by age into classrooms, or any of the other trappings of our standard compulsory system of schooling. All of these, in fact, interfere with children's natural ways of learning. A half century of decline. Free play is how children learn to structure their own behaviour, defined as play in which the players themselves decide what and how to play, and are free to modify the goals and rules as they go along. A terrible irony. We have a terrible irony. In the name of education, we have increasingly deprived children of the time and freedom they need to educate themselves through their own means. And in the name of safety, we have deprived children of the freedom they need to develop the understanding, courage, and confidence required to face life's dangers and challenges with equanimity. We are in a crisis that continues to grow more serious with every passing year. We have lost sight of the natural way to raise children. Throughout the developed world, we have lost sight of children's competence. We have created a world in which children must suppress their natural instincts to take charge of their own education and instead mindlessly follow paths to nowhere laid out for them by adults. We have created a world that is literally driving many young people crazy and leaving many others unable to develop the confidence and skills required for adult responsibility. Trustful parenting. Trustful parenting sends messages to children that are consistent with the real needs of children. You are competent. Social life is not the pitting of will against will, but the helping of one another so that all can have what they need to the most desire. Technical skills and knowledge. It would be a mistake to assume that because hunter-gatherer cultures are simpler than ours, children in those cultures have less to learn than our children do. The hunting and gathering way of life is extraordinary knowledge and skill intensive, and because of the relative absence of occupational specialisation, each child has to acquire essentially the whole culture, or at least that part of it appropriate to his gender. Social skills and values. By allowing their children unlimited time to play with one another, hunter-gatherer adults allow their children unlimited practice of social skills and values that are most central to their way of life. Social play, that is, all play that involves more than one player, is, by its very nature, a continuous exercise in cooperation, attention to one another's needs, and consensual decision-making. Play is not something one has to do. Players are always free to quit. In social play, each player knows that anyone who feels unhappy will quit. And if too many quit, the game ends. To keep the game going, players must satisfy not only their own desires, but also those to other players. The intense drive that children have to play with other children, therefore, is a powerful force for them to learn how to attend to others' wishes and negotiate differences. Self-control. Researchers who study hunter-gatherers often comment on their extraordinary cheerfulness and stoicism. Anthropologist Richard Gould, after quoting another researcher on hunter-gatherers' cheerfulness, wrote, "Often, I have had cause to notice the same good cheer and readiness to laugh and joke among the people of the Gibson Desert, hunter-gatherers in Australia. Even when they are plagued by boils and heat, pestered by flies and short-term of food, this cheerfulness seems to be part of disciplined acceptance of frequent hardships which complaints would only aggravate. Hunter-gatherers seem to accept the twists and turns of fate and make the best of them, rather than complain." Self-control through play. Children's drive to play leads and ignore them discomforts and suppress impulses so they can continue abiding by the rules of the game, and such abilities gradually transfer their lives outside of play. More recently, research with animals suggests that play is essential to development of those parts of the brain that are crucial to controlling fear and anger, and for behaving effectively in stressful situations. Why schools are what they are, the advent of agriculture. Why do we go from conditions in which learning was self-directed and joyful to conditions in which learning was forced on children in ways that make so many of them feel helpless, anxious, and depressed? To understand why things are as they are today, we must know something about the history that created them. For hundreds and thousands of years, humans lived under relatively stable conditions as hunter-gatherers. Our instincts were adapted to that way of life. Then along came agriculture, which once established kicked off an ever-accelerating whirlwind of changes in our ways of living, and those changes dramatically altered our ways of thinking about and rearing children. The hunter-gatherer way of life was knowledge-intensive and skill-intensive, but not labour-intensive. To be effective hunters and gatherers, people had to acquire deep knowledge of the plants and animals in which they depended, and the landscapes in which they foraged. They had to develop skills in crafting and using the tools of hunting and gathering. They had to be creating in finding food, tracking game, and defending against predators. But they did not have to work long hours. In fact, long hours of hunting and gathering would have been counterproductive, as they would have led to harvesting the nature's food supply faster than nature could regenerate. Anthropologists report that hunter-gatherers did not distinguish work from play as we do. They grew up playing at hunting and gathering and moved on gradually to the real thing, still in the spirit of play. They had no concept of work as toil. Apparently, everywhere, the onset of agriculture tended to reduce children's freedom and promote punitive methods of child rearing. In classic study conducted in the 1950s, Herbert Barry, Irvin Child, and Margaret Bacon used anthropological documents to rank primitive societies according to their child rearing philosophies and methods. At one were cultures that stressed obedience and community use corporal punishment. They found that this ranking correlated strongly with the culture's means of subsistence. The more a culture depended on agriculture and less it depended on hunting and gathering, and the more likely it was to value obedience, devalue self-assertion, and use harsh means to discipline children. Subsequent studies have produced similar results. As a number of researchers have pointed out, this cultural difference in child rearing makes sense when we consider the character traits of ideal farmer compared to those of the ideal hunter-gatherer. Success in farming generally depends on adhering to tried and true methods. Creativity is very risky. If a crop fails, a whole year's food supply may be lost. Farmers, unlike hunter-gatherers, don't regularly share food, so a family does not lose its crop and may starve. Moreover, farming societies are generally structured hierarchically, so obedience to those higher in wealth, rank, and power is essential to social and economic success. Thus, the ideal farmer is obedient, rule-abiding, and conservative. Farmers' strict discipline of children seems designed to cultivate those traits. The advent of feudalism and industry. As agriculture spread across the usable land in Europe and Asia, land ownership became tantamount to power and wealth. People without land became dependent on those who owned it. Landowners discovered that they could increase their wealth by getting other people to work for them. Systems of slavery, indentured servitude, and paid labour emerged as a means to supply landowners with workers. Wars were often fought to gain and control land and workers. This was a context in which children grew up. In medieval society, the life purpose of those in the lower classes was to serve and obey those above them. It was this way that education became synonymous with obedience training. It is with this history in mind that we must think about the origins of schools as we know them today, the sins of our system of forced education. Is forced education a good thing or a bad thing? Most people seem to believe that it is, all in all, a good thing, but maybe even necessary. We disagree. Below, we outline what we perceive to be the sins of our system of forced education. 1. Interference with the development of personal responsibility and self-direction. By confining children to school and other adult-directed school-like settings and filling their time with forced busy work, which serves no productive purpose, we deprive them of the time and opportunities they need to practice self-direction and responsibility. And so children themselves, as well as their parents and teachers, come to think that children are incompetent. Over time, as forced schooling has been extended to include people of every older ages, the belief in incompetence has been extended upward. Undermining of intrinsic motivation to learn. Turning learning into work. The biggest, most enduring lesson of school is that learning is work, to be avoided when possible, not joyful play as children would otherwise believe. judging students in ways that fosters shame, hubris, cynicism, and cheating. Our system of grading and ranking to motivate students seem also perfectly designed to promote cynicism and cheating. Students are constantly told about the value of high grades. Advancement through the system and eventual freedom from it depend on them. Students understandably become convinced that high grades are the be-all and end-all of their schoolwork. By the time they are 11 or 12 years old, most are realistically cynical about the idea that school is fundamentally a place for learning. Interference with the development of cooperation and promotion of bullying. By design, school teaches selfishness. The forced competitiveness and the constant grading and ranking of students contain the implicit lesson that each student's job is to look out for himself or herself, and to do better than the others. Helping others may even hurt the helper. By raising the grading curve and lowering the helper's position on it, some of those students who strongly buy into school understand this well. They become ruthless achievers and interested in beating the others than helping them. Inhibition of critical thinking. Presumably, one of the great general goals of education is the cultivation of critical thinking. But despite all the lip service that educators devote to it, most students learn to avoid thinking critically about their schoolwork. They learn that their job in school is to get high marks on tests and that critical thinking interferes to get good grades. You need to figure out what the teacher wants you to say and then say it. Reduction in diversity of skills and knowledge. By forcing all school children to go through the same standard curriculum, we reduce their opportunities to follow alternative pathways. The school curriculum represents a tiny subset of the skills and knowledge that are important to our society. In this day and age, nobody can learn more than a sliver of what they need to know. Why force everyone to learn the same sliver? The value of free age mixing for children. In age mixed groups, the younger children can engage in and learn from activities that would be too complex, difficult, or dangerous for them to do on their own, or only with others their own age. They can also learn simply from watching the more sophisticated activities of older children and overhearing their conversations, and they can receive emotional support and care beyond what age mates could provide. The advantages of age mixing go both directions. By interacting with younger children, older ones practice leadership and nurturance, and they gain experience of being mature one in relationships. Older children can also gain deeper understandings of concepts by teaching younger ones, which lead to them to think about what they do or do not know. Just as older children inspire younger ones to engage in more complex or sophisticated activities than they otherwise would, younger children inspire older ones to engage in more creative activities than they otherwise would. What is play? Play is a concept that fills our minds with contradictions when we try to think deeply about it. Play is serious, yet not serious, imaginative and spontaneous, yet bound by rules and anchored into the real world. It's childish, yet underlies many of the greatest accomplishments of adults. From an evolutionary perspective, play is nature's way of ensuring that children and other young mammals will learn what they must to survive and do well. It's not easy to define play, but it's worth our while to spend some time attempting to do so. As play-defining characteristics are strong clues for explaining its educative power. Here are three general points about play that are worth keeping in mind. First, the characteristics of play all have to do with motivation and mental attitude, not with the overt form of behaviour itself. Two people might be throwing a ball or pounding nails or typing words on a computer, and one might be playing the other while he's not. To tell which one is playing and which is not, you have to infer from their expressions and the detail of their actions something about why they are doing what they are doing with their attitude towards it. The second point towards definition that is play is not necessarily all or none. Play can blend with other motives and attitudes in proportions ranging anywhere from 0 up to 100%. Third, play is not neatly defined in terms of some single identifying characteristic. It's rather defined as a confluence of several characteristics which can be boiled down to five. Play is self-chosen and self-directed. Play is an activity in which activities are more valued than ends. Play has structure or rules that are not dictated by physical necessity but emanate from the minds of the players. Play is imaginative, non-literal, mentally removed in some way or form from real or serious life. Play involves an active, alert but non-stressed frame of mind. The value of dangerous play. In our culture today, parents and other adults overprotect children from possible dangers in play. We seriously underestimate children's ability to take care of themselves and make good judgments. Our underestimation becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. By depriving children of freedom, we deprive them of the opportunities they need to learn how to take control of their own behaviour and emotions. How to become a more trustful parent. Many parents would like to adopt a more trustful style, but find it hard to do so. If you're one of them, how can you become a more trustful parent and allow your children more freedom? Here are some suggestions. Examine your own values. What is a good life? What sorts of experiences make life worthwhile? The first step towards trustful parenting is to examine your own values and think about how they might apply to your children and your relationship with them. Let go of the idea that you determine your child's future. If we value freedom and personal responsibility, we must respect our children's rights to chart their own lives. Resist the temptation to monitor your child's activities. Trustful parents resist urges to be in continuous contact with their children, to monitor their activities and inquire about the details of their day. Find or create safe places and opportunities for children to play and explore. Consider alternatives to conventional schooling. Our social obligation. We do have a social obligation to provide rich educational opportunities for every child, regardless of his or her family background and income. There are many possible ways to do this. One possibility would be a system of voluntary, non-coercive schools where children could play, explore, and learn in an environment conducive to healthy intellectual, physical, and moral development.